From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Inside the Hermit Kingdom, eyewitness views from North Korea. I'm Todd Purdom, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To the Point. It's the most isolated nation in the modern world, a closed society, a place where teenagers have never heard of Beyonce, and Facebook is just a mysterious word. North Korea is also a parallel universe in which the United States is an evil empire bent on destruction, and patriotic North Koreans take it for granted that they would crush America in a nuclear war. As Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un escalate their war of words, we'll hear from journalists who've had rare access to Pyongyang. How worried should we be? Later on today's Talking Point, we'll take a look at a little-known phenomenon, newer Confederate monuments, built in recent years to memorialize the Old South's lost cause. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's All News Channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more. 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
I'm Todd Purdom, in for Warren Olney, back with To the Point. In a moment, we'll get a rare first-hand look inside North Korea, the most isolated nation in the modern world. Is it the flashpoint of a new Cold War that might turn hot? Then, on today's Talking Point, we'll focus on a newer battlefront in the fight over Confederate history, recently built monuments that honor the Southern side in the war between the states. First, this news update. A fresh development in Spain's fight with Catalonia over separatism. The Spanish Prime Minister, Mariano Rajoy, today took the first tentative step toward imposing administrative control over the would-be breakaway region. He asked the Catalan President, Carles Puigdemont, to clarify whether he'd actually meant to declare independence in a speech yesterday. If he did, the Spanish government's prepared to invoke a provision in the national constitution that would suspend Catalonia's autonomous administration. The situation's a bit fluid. For an explanation, we turn to Rafael Minder, a Spain-based reporter for The New York Times who's been following the situation. Rafael, welcome.
Thank you.
You're the author of a book called The Struggle for Catalonia. Can you clarify the latest developments on the ground in this long-running fight?
Well, basically, we had on Tuesday night a half-baked declaration of independence from the Catalan leader who declared but suspended independence. And today we've had a request for clarification from the government of Mariano Rajoy, central government in Madrid, saying, giving essentially the Catalan leader an ultimatum to clarify whether he really meant that Catalonia has declared independence or not. And if he did, Mr. Rajoy, the prime minister, told us that he is going to be using emergency powers granted to him under Spain's constitution, and these powers could go as far as essentially taking over the Catalan administration, suspending lawmakers in Catalonia, and possibly go further than that. It could also involve suspending the Catalan public broadcaster.
Has this provision, Article 155 of the Spanish Constitution, ever been invoked before?
Never. I mean, the Spanish Constitution is relatively recent. It's from 1978. It's the constitution that allowed Spain to make a transition from the Franco dictatorship back to democracy. It's never been used, which is also why defining exactly what powers the prime minister could use is impossible. It's untested territory. And what we can say is that it's very broad, so he can make it as forceful or as weak as he wants. It also doesn't set any limits on how long an intervention could take. So it's essentially his choice. He could say that Madrid needs to be in full control of Catalonia for months, or could just be weeks or even longer. No, no one knows. It's not something that has any precedent to work from.
We're speaking with Rafael Minder, a New York Times reporter based in Spain, about the latest in the Spanish-Catalonian standoff. Rafael, as you know, modern Spain is a comparatively young democracy. Is what's going on now an existential crisis or a kind of growing pains of a country that's finding its way?
I think it's both, but it is an existential crisis in the sense that this is the most serious challenge that this... it is a young democracy, but it looks certainly like a stable one. Spain is now considered one of the pillars of the European Union. It's a country that's actually showing strong growth, at least by European standards. So this is a real test. And I mean, the democracy of Spain was tested once a few years after the transition when there was an attempted military coup. But that was a 24-hour story that essentially never had public support. I mean, it was a very different situation to now. We're talking about the economic engine of Spain, the region that has really led the industrial development of Spain, wanting to break away and taking with it a fifth of the country's GDP and 16% of the population. So this would very much be the equivalent, in fact, comparatively even bigger, of California seceding from the United States.
Mr. Puigdemont made his quasi-declaration in a speech to the parliament, right? What's his latest clarification today? Has he said he's open to talks with no preconditions? What's his current stance?
That's what he said today, but it's an offer that falls on deaf ears because the no preconditions is unacceptable from the point of view of Madrid. The precondition for any talks in Madrid is that any secession plan has to be off the table. Talks have to take place within a return to the rules and the framework of the current constitution, and that constitution doesn't foresee for any region of Spain to secede.
Because Madrid considers the referendum of October 1st to be illegitimate at its core, right?
It's considered it to be illegitimate from the start. It has had the support of the Constitutional Court that actually suspended the referendum before it was held. And so essentially we've had a process where we have parallel views on the law. We have a part of Spain considering that its laws can somehow trump those of the federal government because it says, anyway, we want to get rid of the federal laws.
Thanks very much, Rafael Minder of The New York Times. In a moment, a firsthand report on the tense situation in North Korea. On To The Point from PRI.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
I'm Todd Purdom, in for Warren Olney, back with To The Point. Donald Trump calls North Korea's Kim Jong-un Rocket Man. Kim calls the president a rogue and a dotard. Behind the war of insults is a dangerous geopolitical standoff and a looming nuclear threat. President Trump tweeted just this weekend, only one thing will work. Tensions with North Korea, an anti-American trash talk from its dictator regime, is hardly new. Western options for defusing the situation and for deterring Pyongyang's nuclear capability have always been limited. What's different now is President Trump's bellicose tit-for-tat and the prospect that a miscalculation could set off a crisis no one wants. Nicholas Kristof, a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for The New York Times, is just back from a rare trip to North Korea. He's a veteran visitor to that forbidden nation, and he found tensions higher than ever. Nick, welcome to The Point.
Good to be with you, Todd.
Could you give us your take on the situation? What is the mood there like in Pyongyang, and especially how's it differed from... You've been going off and on since 1989, I think, right?
Yeah, that's right. So it is entirely different from my past visits to Pyongyang. At one level, there is this very eerie expectation in the capital that war is imminent, and not just any war, but a nuclear war. And person after person, both officials and ordinary people, said that they expected that a war was going to break out, that there would be nuclear exchanges, and, you know, still more remarkable, they kept insisting that they would not only survive this nuclear war, but that North Korea would triumph, would defeat the U.S. in this war. And, you know, look, Todd, it's hard to know what to make of propaganda and what people really think versus what is the message that they're trying to send you. But it left me kind of shaken about the possibility for some kind of a miscalculation that would lead to not just a war like Afghanistan or Iraq or even Vietnam, but a nuclear war that would be the greatest cataclysm since World War II.
Forgive the ignorance of this question, but since the North Korean society is so closed and access to information is so limited, do you think the North Koreans you talk to actually understand the scientific and physical and medical impacts of nuclear weapons and what would happen to them or us if they were used?
So among the people I spoke to were foreign ministry officials who are very savvy, know a great deal. And I think that they understand the consequences. And in fact, I think that perhaps one reason I was given a visa and allowed to go was precisely that the foreign ministry may be trying to find an exit ramp from this collision, just as the State Department in Washington is trying to find an exit ramp. But in both cases, the people trying to make peace are being marginalized by hardliners in each city, by those who see no point in dialogue and tend to reach for military options. As for ordinary people, it's really hard to know, but it is striking that the North Korean narrative of history that people are steeped in, and this is a country that isn't exactly hermetically sealed, but pretty close. The entire narrative that people grow up in is that they defeated the U.S. in the Korean War, and repeatedly since then, the U.S. has tried to invade or tried to intrude and has been slapped down because of the wise leadership of the Kim family. And so if that's the only version of reality that you know, perhaps it is possible to think that, yeah, we've defeated those American imperialist bastards repeatedly, and we can do it again.
One of the most telling things you wrote in the Times on Sunday was that on this visit, you were restricted from having contact with members of the security service or the military establishment, presumably for fear on the part of your minders in the foreign ministry that harm might befall you if those people got their hands on you.
Yeah, this was one of the more unsettling things about the trip. In the past, I had been able to interview military officials, and I'd stayed at hotels in, regular business hotels in Pyongyang. This time, I was kept at a foreign ministry-owned guest house outside of the city among the rice paddies guarded by armed guards. And at first, I thought this was simply to protect North Koreans from my own inquiries, from my own dangerous reporting. But it gradually became clear that this was for our own security and that the foreign ministry was concerned that I might perhaps get into some mischief and the security forces would pounce, that they were not on board with this kind of outreach to American journalists. They regarded American journalists as spies, and that the foreign ministry didn't want to have another American detainee to deal with. And, of course, I didn't want that either.
How did you handle your American electronics? Did you take a special cell phone or laptop with you so that there wouldn't be questions of espionage, or is that not a risk in Korea the way it is in China?
I think it is a risk. I did bring a clean laptop, wiped clean, and but I did bring my regular phone and just kept it with me at all times. As I entered the country, the customs officials went through my phone and they examined iMovies, which in my case, I'm not a movie watcher on my phone, so there weren't any. They examined iBooks, and they also examined all my photos. And there was an awkward moment where in my photos, they found repeated photos of this Asian woman whom they were very suspicious of. I think they thought she was my South Korean, CIA controller.
But that's no Asian woman. That's your wife, right?
Exactly. So they asked who she was, and I said, oh, that's my wife. And so they were very deflated.
For a slightly different perspective, let's turn now to Suki Kim, a contributing editor at The New Republic and author of Without You, There Is No Us, Undercover Among the Sons of North Korea's Elite. She's had a very unusual experience herself in North Korea. Suki, welcome to The Point.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Could you tell us just a little bit about your own background and why you had this especially unusual, almost unique perch inside North Korean society as an undercover teacher of English?
Well, I was born and raised in South Korea, and I also come from families who got separated by the Korean War. And I did go from 2002 by joining a pro-North Korean organization to do a piece for the New York Review of Books. Then I went repeatedly throughout a decade, realizing each trip. I also covered the New York Philharmonic visit to Pyongyang for Harper's Magazine. And none of those, I felt like I was really able to get into the sort of, I guess, the crux of what North Korea might be, and also endless interviews with defectors, which also gives you just one glimpse of the sort of bottom layer of the society. So in 2011, I had been after this organization that was run by fundamental evangelical Christians who are now setting up a university in Pyongyang for the sons of North Korea's elite, the creme de la creme. So I essentially posed as one of the teachers or, you know, got that unpaid job as a ESL teacher and a fundamental evangelical, which I'm not. But to live there. So I ended up living there in 2011. Of course, that's the very important year when Kim Jong-il died. Mm-hmm. And I lived with these young men who were about age 20, about 270 of them in a military compound during the time when entire North Korea, they shut down universities for a year and put every university student into construction field. So that would explain who my students were.
Wow. And so when was the last time you were there? 2011 is when you...
That was it. I mean, that I knew because, you know, I'd been working on this book for really, I guess, by then a decade. So I knew that once this came out, that was it, you know. And so it was sort of like, I guess, the pinnacle of the research that took a really long time.
What do you make from afar, admittedly, of the current situation, particularly rhetorically and the kind of reporting that Nick's come back with? Is this just more of the same or is there something qualitatively different about what's happening now?
Well, I mean, I think that the heightened war tension, I never saw that change in any of my time. Living with them, finally, I think that I was, you know, I was after sort of what they're thinking. And what they're thinking really is led by this you know, war tension that's imminent. The whole point is not that there's a war, but it's imminent because the U.S. is the greatest threat, because the entire great leader myth is built on that. You know, great leader protects them from America who cut up Korea. You know, at the heart of it is the division of Korea back in 1945,
yes.
Which really started all of this
yes.
as a U.S. being the greatest threat that the Korean Peninsula has. So this great leader mythology and the war threat being heightened at all time is always the way it is.
Always there, yeah.
Being born and raised in it. I guess that what Nick was talking about, that mistake that can happen, we are now living in a time that the leaders of neither nation, they're not coming across as very trustworthy.
Pause right
I
there
guess.
For a second, Suki. This is Suki Kim, a contributing editor of The New Republic. I want to turn back to Nick Kristof of The New York Times on that point. Nick, could you describe in a little greater detail the feeling in the air there, the military marches in the streets, the sort of almost war footing that the country seemed to be on?
Sure. And so everywhere you go, to a degree that was not true on my past visits, there are posters and billboards showing missiles that are hitting the U.S.,
Are they hitting Los Angeles or are they hitting Oregon?
Where no, they? Actually, they're hitting the U.S. Capitol building. But I think that may just be iconography, that the U.S. Capitol is more recognizable than something in
Yamhill, Oregon.
Los Angeles or Santa Monica. On the plane flying into Pyongyang, there was a television monitor that was showing a military concert, and it was all very dignified and moving. And then those scenes of the music that were interspersed with scenes of missiles being launched. And there are parades of young people marching around the streets every day in military uniform. Everybody supposedly had signed up for the military reserves. And of course, when everybody does it, that says less about them than mm-hmm. about the government. Mm-hmm. So there's this air of mobilization. And I think Suki is exactly right that, you know, the government is, you know, what does the Kim regime base its legitimacy on? It's not its economic achievements, but rather it is that they are the authentic defenders of a peninsula that has been bullied and ravaged by neighbors from Japan to China and America. Everybody wants to nibble away at it, to dismember it, to occupy it. And they, the Kim family, have been the protectors of Korean nationalism. And I think that it's in that context that President Trump's remarks about, you know, totally destroying Korea, that they leverage them to their own advantage for their own legitimacy.
And yes, yes. On that point, Nick, that's Nick Kristof of The New York Times. I'd like to turn to Young Lee, who is deputy director of the Korea program at Stanford University's Shorenstein Asia-Pacific Research Center. Professor Lee, is, in fact, Donald Trump's rhetoric what's really different in the situation here? I mean, we've had this standoff with North Korea in one real sense since 1953. What's different about it? Is it because we have a leader in Washington who's giving it right back to them?
Yes, I think it is different. And so we've always, you know, heard about North Korea's rhetoric. They've been bullying, making threats. And the way South Korea or the U.S. has responded is in more of a diplomatic and civilized way, because that's how it's normally done. But Trump's eye for an eye approach actually has made North Korea a bit unstable and wary about what this actually implies. Recently, and there's reports that indicated that North Koreans actually reached out to Republicans to try to understand what Trump's real motivations were. And this may not necessarily be a bad thing, I think. If it is true that this clash of words between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump may escalate into tension. But up to now, there's been no incentive for either party to actually reach a deal. But when the stakes are this high, when we're in front of a nuclear war, there's an imminent war, and as Mr. Kristof indicated, it seems higher even in North Korea. And also, North Korea has developed economically in the past few years. That means their stakes are higher, too. I think this actually points to a situation that we haven't had before. And it could be a real threat, a real concern, but it could be potentially be an opportunity.
What are the complications in the region? Our options are somewhat limited. We pin our hopes on China, but China has a complex economic and geopolitical relationship with North Korea that makes it not so eager to jump down hard on them, right?
That's right. China, so it's what baffles me is that the way the U.S. thinks that China could actually intervene and change North Korea's behavior, but China actually, if you think about their incentive, they care more about regional security and stability. The North Korea nuclear problem is a problem for the U.S., but for China, it's a North Korea problem, and the nuclear weapon is just one factor.
Suki Kim of the New Republic, could I ask you, what do Americans need to know about the way we're perceived by North Koreans, a society that's so isolated? Do they think we have, is our understanding of what they think actually naive and arrogant in their view?
From their view, what America is, I mean, it's a really a fascinating way of double think is really what I faced when I lived with their young men who are going to be their leaders. Is there's this constant war propaganda stuff where U.S. is their enemy, you know, like they're term for classroom was platoon. They call the workplace, the word choice is actually battlefield, like all the time. It's war language. But at the same time, you know, I'm American, I'm South Korean, and I absolutely adore them.
We'll take a brief break and we'll be back with our panel. Later, on Talking Point, we'll examine a wave of newly built Confederate monuments sparking debate over Civil War history and 21st century civil rights. This is To the Point from PRI. I'm Todd Purdom, back with To the Point. We're talking about the tensions between Washington and North Korea with Nicholas Kristof of The New York Times, Suki Kim of The New Republic, and Yang Lee, Deputy Director of the Korea Program at the Shorenstein Asia-Pacific Research Center up at Stanford University. We're joined now by NPR's National Security Correspondent David Wellner in Washington. David, I gather you've just been watching a press conference in which President Trump is even now talking about North Korea.
Yes, indeed, Todd. He was asked about initially about NBC TV's report that he had asked for a tenfold increase in the U.S. nuclear stockpile at a meeting at the Pentagon back in July. He he categorically denied that he said anything of the kind and said that Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis would be putting out a statement. Mattis was also at the meeting that would back him up on that. He said that we don't need to increase our arsenal now, but I want to modernize and rehabilitate it. So that's kind of what got the ball rolling. And then he was asked specifically about North Korea. And he said, I think I have a little bit different attitude on North Korea than other people might have, without explaining it. He said, I listen to everybody, but ultimately my attitude is the one that matters, isn't it? That's the way it works. That's the way the system is.
Wow.
And indeed, he is the one who could decide on launching a nuclear attack on North Korea and have virtually nobody standing in the way.
Well, you know, David, so often American policymakers have struggled to discern what North Korea's true intentions are. It seems now we're all struggling to discern what the White House's true intentions are. What's your best read on what President Trump is really saying here?
Well, I think that at this point, we're hearing a lot of rhetoric out of the White House. It's sort of matching the rhetoric coming from North Korea and Kim Jong-un. But I think that he's also saying that he's keeping this as an actual plausible option, using nuclear weapons against North Korea. He said, he went on to say that he thinks he feels stronger and tougher on this subject than other people, and that he would do what's right for the United States and really what's right for the world. Well, you know, this doesn't sound like somebody who's saying, I'm going to sit down at a negotiating table and hammer out a deal with North Korea. It sounds more like somebody who wants to make some very bold gesture. Now, we do have nearly 30,000 U.S. forces in South Korea, and we also have warships around that region, and conventional warfare is always an option, too. But everybody agrees that any kind of warfare in that area would be catastrophic to the people who live on the Korean Peninsula, both in the north and the south.
David, as you know, it is the president who would have the authority to launch a nuclear attack, and you recently reported on just what that would look like. Can you walk us through the steps that would be involved in that, you know, ominous invocation of the nuclear football that the president could do?
Right. Well, we have two scenarios. One is if there is a report that there's an incoming nuclear-tipped missile, and this would require very immediate action by the president. In fact, if word reached him at the White House that such an attack was underway, he could actually have a response from the United States launched within minutes. The whole system is set up for him to act extremely quickly and for really nobody to get in the way of him doing that. The big question, I think, is about Trump undertaking a preemptive strike, a first strike against another country. And in that case, really the system is just about exactly the same. He would have the military attaché who carries the black satchel with the military launch codes in it with him. He could consult what kind of attack he wanted to carry out. There would be codes that would go with it. He would contact the Pentagon. He talked to the deputy director of operations there at the war room in the Pentagon. That deputy director would verify his identity by challenging him to match some codes. This is something he would do with something called a biscuit that he carries with him that has some codes on it. Once his identity is verified, those launch orders are transmitted. They would go to the U.S. Strategic Command out near Omaha, yeah. And from there they would go to either missile silos based in Western states, nuclear submarines, or nuclear bombers, or all three of them.
That's David Wellna of NPR. Nicholas Kristof of The New York Times. As David points out, conventional military action is a possibility, too, but there are hundreds of thousands of Americans, millions of South Koreans who would be in harm's way. We'd presumably have to take actions to move those people. That would tip any hand to North Korea. What are the realities of even conventional military action in that area?
Well, so back in 1994, General Gary Luck, who is the commander of U.S. forces in Korea, estimated that a war, non-nuclear war, a traditional war in the Korean Peninsula, would result in 1 million casualties and $1 trillion in damage. Now, of course, that's enormous, but it would be the problem is that any conventional war today would quite quickly escalate into a nuclear war. And when you do war games involving the Korean Peninsula, then again, there's pressure on both sides to escalate because they're on a hair trigger, and each side is worried about the North wants to use it or lose it, and the U.S. wants to remove their launch capacity before they can launch missiles. So there's things tend to escalate very, very quickly. And I guess I worry that a war, I don't think President Trump actually really wants a war, but I think that it could happen. I can imagine him trying to strike a striking a North Korean missile on its launch pad. Just
take it out before
it's being tested. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And
but they've said they'll interpret that as a tremendously provocative act, right?
Well, I asked about that, and the North Koreans said that, yes, that would be the beginning of an all-out war, of a nuclear war. And also, we sent B-1 bombers near the North Korean coast, and North Korea did not respond. There's some debate about exactly why, but if they did scramble fighter planes and one was shot down, one could also see them responding in a kinetic way to that. And just also, this is a highly armed area where accidents happen. 1994, a U.S. helicopter just strayed over the DMZ.
Yes.
And so accidents happen. There can be these, collisions, where incidents like one plane being shot down that would result in a war that would just be cataclysmic. The one recent estimate indicated that if nuclear weapons were detonated over Seoul and Tokyo, then 2 million people could be killed in just those two cities alone.
That's Nick Kristof of The New York Times. Young Kim of Stanford University, what do you think North Korean diplomats and the North Korea establishment are making of the president's words, including just today? They must be working overtime. Are there any intermediaries they can go to? You mentioned earlier there's some speculation they're trying to reach out to Republicans in Congress. Is there any back channel that the North Koreans have to sort of interpret Donald Trump to them?
So I think that's one of the limitations. They have so little intermediaries. I mean, through the UN, they have a few. But especially given that this is not just the Republican Party, it's actually Donald Trump, and he explicitly said that he's the one who's making these decisions. It's even for us, if it's difficult, even then for them, it would probably be even more puzzling to make out of this. So I think they're taking all scenarios into account. The scenarios that were mentioned, and just have to prepare for that on their account as well.
Soo Ki Kim of The New Republic, in a paradoxical or perverse way, is President Trump making the Kim's regime job easier by sort of buttressing the American image as the devil incarnate and, the source of all evil? Is he actually doing some of their work for them?
Yeah, I think it's like the best thing that's happened for the North Korean propaganda, because everything they've been saying, he's acting it out. He said he'll totally destroy North Korea, which is what the great leader myth has always said. That's what U.S. wants. So here we are talking about the what might happen if a war to break out. I mean, we're really talking about human beings, millions of them. So right now, it seems that the only sort of thing we're looking at as that could make a mistake is actually from Donald Trump's end, right? The mistake that Nicholas keeps talking about, that accidents that can happen, I mean, that could really happen from the American side in many sense. And it's just frightening consequences.
Well, we've seen in the Cuban Missile Crisis, remember, Nick, of course, President Kennedy said there's always some poor son of a gun, he didn't quite use that word, who doesn't get the word when the U.S. spy plane strayed over Soviet airspace, seemingly in a provocative way. It was an accident. But, I mean, their accidents do happen, right?
Yeah, they sure do. And the problem now is that there aren't communications channels. The military hotline does no longer exist between North Korea and the U.S., and when you ratchet up tensions this much and each side is talking about the nuclear destruction of the other, then you're on such a hair trigger that things escalate very, very quickly. And so there have been this whole series of incidents that just happen inevitably in along the DMZ, like that 1994 incident where the helicopter strayed over. And in the past, they didn't set off World War III, partly because nuclear arms weren't at stake, but also partly because there was a certain amount of willingness to just pause for a moment. I'm afraid that that pause may no longer be there.
David Wellna of NPR, what are your sources in the Pentagon and the National Security Establishment telling you about what the generals and admirals are advising the president about what's really possible versus what he'd like to do in maybe a comic book fantasy world?
Well, I think that the public line from them has been that all options are on the table, and that they're keeping their military options open. But they preface that constantly, especially Secretary of Defense Mattis, by saying that that this is a conflict that should be resolved diplomatically, through economic sanctions, other measures that are non-military. I think that he's hearing from his national security advisors a pretty unified message that it would be a fool's errand to use nuclear weapons against North Korea, because we have no idea what their response would be and how quickly it could escalate.
There is some movement afoot in Congress, right? Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts and Ted Lieu of Los Angeles, congressman, to limit the president's ability to do a nuclear first strike. That would be an unusual incursion in the modern nuclear protocols. But is that getting any traction in your view?
It hasn't even had a hearing in Congress. It's not terribly surprising. Although Bob Corker, who has crossed swords with President Trump in recent days, is the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, which would consider Markey's bill. Now, this is a bill that says that if the president is going to use first strike a nuclear first strike against another nation, that he would first have to have the permission of Congress, which, of course, the Constitution says can only declare war. The strange situation with North Korea is that, in fact, a war that began in the early 1950s has never formally concluded. They only have an armistice. So, in fact,
and it was a police action at the time, right? It was not technically a war ever.
Yes, but in fact, the U.S. is as much at war, technically speaking.
Understood, as it ever
as
was.
Then. Yeah. And so even if Lieu and Markey's bill were to be approved by Congress, I guess that you could hear an argument from the White House, well, we don't even have to seek permission when it comes to North Korea. Things are not anywhere close to that point. But that's the only effort that I know of in Congress to limit the president's power. We do have the 1946 Atomic Energy Act that President Truman signed that gives the president full authority to launch a nuclear strike. And Congress would have to, in effect, override that if we're going to pass anything else.
David, if President Trump denied today that he'd sought the kind of increase in the nuclear arsenal that the NBC report says he did, what is his policy on the state of our nuclear arsenal or the size of it? And what does your reporting tell you that the White House really wants?
Well, you know, not long after he got elected back in November, he promised to, in his words, greatly strengthen and expand the U.S. nuclear capability. So this seems to be something on his agenda, even though today he said that really what he wants is simply that our nuclear arsenal be in perfect working order, that it be modernized and rehabilitated. It sounds like that's the kind of language that you would be hearing more from the generals at the Pentagon, that they think that a modernization is needed of the U.S. nuclear arsenal. We're going to have to see what Secretary Mattis says actually transpired in that meeting. It's hard to imagine that he would be going out to contradict the president on this, but everything that Mattis has said, as I said before, has suggested that he does not relish the thought of using military force of any kind on the Korean Peninsula.
Young Lee of Stanford University, Senator Corker, who has, of course, announced his retirement and thus maybe be speaking more freely, has warned that this kind of brinkmanship could lead to World War III. What's your sense about the policy-making community and other, you know, establishment figures in the government? Do you think that they share similar concerns and are just not voicing them?
In general, I think the concern here is people's voices are that these are rational actors and they know the consequences. So, the sense I'm getting around here is that it's unlikely to result in a war, and the rhetorics are different from diplomacy that's actually happening. So, I'm not sure exactly how many people do believe that this will actually escalate into World War III.
Well, stand by. Thanks to our guests, Nick Kristof of The New York Times, Suki Kim of The New Republic, Young Lee of Stanford University, and NPR's own David Wellner. In a minute, we'll be back to talk about the latest battlefront in the war over Confederate monuments. This is To the Point from PRI. I'm Todd Purdom, here with today's Talking Point. The recent debates over Confederate Civil War monuments have focused mostly on memorials built long ago, either in the Jim Crow era of the late 19th century or those built some 50 years ago as the modern civil rights movement gathered steam. In both cases, historians agree, the real goal of those who built the statues and put up the plaques went well beyond honoring a lost cause and was aimed at least partly at intimidating black Americans who sought to win their full birthright as citizens. The Washington Post has now shed fresh light on a little-known third category of memorials, those erected just in the last few years. The Post found that at least 50 more modest Confederate monuments have been built since 1990, some of them even in northern states. We're joined now by Kimberly Kindy, one of the Post reporters who broke the story. Kimberly, welcome to The Point.
Thanks for having me.
What's behind this recent wave of monuments, and why have they sort of escaped the public debate?
Well, I think that a lot of them are really small, and maybe they have gone unnoticed. What we wanted to do, I mean, it popped out to us that there were all of these new monuments, and we wanted to take a close look at them. And they are, as you said, they're more modest, but the purpose behind them, according to, historians that have sort of watched this trend over decades, is they said much the same. The idea is to erect a monument that will promote the cause of the Confederacy. And, they say there's no denying that part of that is sort of putting your stamp in town, saying, much as they were trying to say in the Jim Crow era, that this is our town. Hmm. Now, the people who are, part of the Sons of Confederate Veterans, who are really like behind probably 80% of these new monuments that have been built, unlike the old monuments where the Daughters of Confederate Veterans raised the money and put them up, they say that that's not the case at all, that they are simply trying to honor people around town who have died, who fought as in the Confederate Army, and trying to make sure that their heritage and their history isn't lost. They feel like the South fought to defend their land, preserve slavery.
Yes. Is any of this in any sense a backlash to the recent, removal of Confederate signs and symbols from state flags and logos and so forth? Or, for that matter, is any of it a backlash to the Obama administration and the first black president?
Well, an interesting thing, when I was talking to the national headquarters, they said that they want to and encourage the local chapters to do these small monuments because the idea, they said, is to spread the word and have it as widespread as possible about what their group represents and what the Confederacy represents and to be part of every town in America if they can, if there's some history there. But at the same time, as they say that these small monuments are kind of the way they want to go, they also voted in just weeks before Obama was elected as a board, and as polls were showing that he was going to probably be the victor, they voted to start raising $5 million for an expansive museum that they will build in Tennessee by their headquarters. This will be funded by them, and they will write the history. And they say that they want to write the history. Their belief is that the victor writes the history. The reason why the history books say this was all about slavery is because the North wrote it that way, and they believe it's about something else, and they want a museum that declares their version of things.
When you say these monuments are smaller, they're not only physically smaller, right? I mean, they don't tend to be big statues. They're more like obelisks or small stones. But don't they also memorialize, or they tend to, foot soldiers more than generals? Is that part of the strategy, too, to make them acceptable?
Right, yes. When you ask them about it, that is a very common defense. This is about the soldier that was out there fighting for their family. We're not glamorizing or glorizing the generals. And when you talk to them, they say that is like their intended purpose. When you talk to Civil War historians that have followed the monument building, they say that this is a calculated defense. I don't know. But those are the sort of the two sides of how people view what the strategy is about.
How did you and your post colleague Julie Tate become aware of this story? How did you get onto this trend?
Well, we were looking at, this became such a huge issue, one of the questions we had was, can we identify where they're at? If they're going to start becoming flashpoints, it would be good to know where they are. And so the Southern Poverty Law Center has a map that they put together that has a lot of them, but not all of them. They say it doesn't even have all of them. And we started with that, and we went from 1990 forward because we saw that there were a number of modern ones, and we thought that was interesting. And then we created our own spreadsheet and analyzed each of them because they didn't have, who financed it, didn't have images of them and what they looked like. And from doing that sort of deeper analysis on the 50 that they had identified, we found a couple that maybe shouldn't have been in there and a couple that should have been, so it rounded out to about 50. We saw that we're talking about things that are 7 or 8 feet tall. Some of them are stone. Some of them are, we got the idea and the character of them.
Interesting.
And we saw that Sons of Confederate Veterans really were the primary financiers.
Right. We're talking with Kimberly Kindy of the Washington Post about modern Confederate memorials. Kimberly, have any of these SOCAR become flashpoints the way the Statue of General Lee in Charlottesville was?
Well, I think that much in the way that these are smaller scale, the protests have been quieter and smaller scale, so you may not even know about them. I wouldn't have known that the one in St. Cloud, I went to St. Cloud, Florida, because it was a really interesting town that is in Central Florida that was set up literally as a retirement community for Union soldiers in a Confederate state. So it's an interesting little flashpoint where you've got a small town that's struggling with the history that is sort of conflicting, and they have these dueling monuments literally in their Veterans Park that are the same size, one a Union, one a Confederate one. And if I hadn't gone there to interview people and to kind of tell this story, I wouldn't have learned that the Confederate one had been defaced after fatal rally that happened in Charlottesville.
Interesting.
And somebody had come up and wrote One Nation, USA One Nation in black spray paint, and then had taken some chunks out of the monument.
Definitely no substitute for showing up quickly because we're running out of time. But you did also run into a very interesting fellow there, an African-American descendant of a Confederate veteran, right?
That's right. He is a member of that St. Cloud Confederate Veterans Group, and his grandfather was a slave. He followed his master and sons into the war. As legend has it, and as he said, he remembers his grandfather telling him during horse and buggy rides when he was 6 or 7, he eventually became a rifleman and fought side by side. And his belief is that his father was treated well and honored for his service, and that his father was a Confederate soldier. And his belief is that the flag is not a racist symbol, the Confederate flag. So he goes around. He's become quite popular in the Confederate circles. He goes around and talks a lot. 2 years ago, when the Virginia governor moved to successfully remove the Sons of Confederate Veterans license plates as a license plate that's available in Virginia, he was flown in to testify. So he's become a pretty interesting figure in that group.
And how old is this gentleman?
He's 88 years old, and he's a retired school teacher.
And he doesn't really have any ambivalence about this particular legacy?
Not at all. He's very proud of it. His grandfather was asked to be buried in his Confederate uniform and was.
What's your own family history? Do you have anybody on the other side of the war?
You know what? I don't even know. I really don't. It's interesting. I'm not sure. It's never come up, and I'd have to do a little bit of research in order to find out.
Well, it's a most unusual story, and thanks for digging it out and sharing a little time with us today. One last question. Do you think that this campaign is going to get any steam building more in the wake of the recent controversies just very quickly?
Well, you know, like I said, the people who have followed this over time say that that generally you see a surge one of the things I think that we're going to see is the continuation of the building of these smaller, newer monuments. In this modern era, are you going to be able to go to a city council and get approval to build a towering monument to Robert E. Lee? Probably not. But are you going to be able to get them to approve a 7-foot modest monument in the little local park? Yeah, maybe. And so I think that's the thing that we're going to continue to see. And it remains to be seen how many people go to this huge museum that is going to be built to the Confederacy in Tennessee.
Where in Tennessee is that going to be built?
Oh, gosh, I should know this. I'm sorry, I don't have that city. But if you Google Sons of the Confederate Veterans and you look for their national headquarters in Tennessee, it's going to be right there.
Great. Thanks very much, Kimberly Kindy of The Washington Post, for sharing a most unusual story.
Well, thanks for having me.
Join us again for To the Point. It's a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.